Hey guys, the following podcast is a Lady Gang Network and Podcast One production, which means it's going to be awesome. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas. And before you skip to the meat of this episode, listen up because I've got some really exciting news. Today marks the start of our third year of this podcast. And with that, I have some exciting changes to the show. I've listened to all of you and I've heard you say over and over that two books a month is just too many. So we're going to be moving to one book club pick per month. This way, you're going to have plenty of time to read along with me and my guests. So here's how it will work moving forward. The first Wednesday of every month, I will be interviewing a guest. They'll be talking about their reading habits, giving you book recommendations, the same as you're used to. Then on the last Wednesday of every month, that guest will be back and we'll be discussing the book in detail. The weeks in between will be filled with author interviews a la The Short Stacks, fun book recommendation shows, summer preview, a gift buying guide, and a lot more. So to break that down for you, first week of the month is going to be that interview episode. In between, we're going to have fun author interviews, short stacks, etc. And then the last week of the month will be the Stacks Book Club conversation. I'll be announcing the book club pick the last week of the month before. So for example, I announced our April book club pick, Trust Exercise by Susan Choi, the last week of March. I'll also be posting about our book club pick the first of every month. So if you want to know a little bit early, you've got to tune into the podcast. Otherwise, you can find it on our social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. Those are the major changes for the show for now. I'm always open to your feedback, so please reach out on social media or head to our website, thestackspodcast.com. You can also find links to all of our social media accounts in the show notes, as well as links to everything that we talked about on today's episode. My final announcement is that I've switched things up in my audiobook listening, and I want you all to do the same. My newest partner is Libro.fm. In this time of uncertainty for many independent bookstores, I wanted the Stacks to help promote the wonderful work that they do in our communities, and Libro.fm felt like a great way to show my love for our local indies. Libro.fm lets you purchase audiobooks directly from your favorite local bookstore. You can pick from over 150,000 audiobooks and get recommendations from booksellers around the country. With Libro.fm, you'll get the same audiobooks at the same price as the largest audiobook company out there. You know who I'm talking about. But you'll be a part of a much different story, one that supports your community. Listeners of The Stacks can get a 3-month audiobook membership for the price of one. Go to Libro.fm, that's Libro.fm, and enter The Stacks at checkout. I'm so excited about joining up with Libro.fm that I've put together a playlist on their website of some of my most favorite audiobooks and some of the audiobooks I'm most looking forward to checking out. There's a link to that playlist in the show notes. When you join Libro.fm, with each listen, you can take pride in knowing that you're supporting local bookstores. As we start the third season, just a friendly reminder that your ratings and reviews help the show reach new audiences and build our community here of book friends. So please take a moment to leave a sentence or two about what you love most about this podcast. For example, a recent review came from Crystal in Wisconsin. Here's what she said. I recently started listening to the podcast when Jason Reynolds was on. So glad to find this great place to hear about books and other media. That's it. That's the review. It's simple, it's 5 stars, and it's super helpful. So please take a moment to rate and review this podcast. Okay. Whew, that was a lot. Thank you guys so much for listening to all of that. Now let's get to the episode. I'm joined today by Brandon Taylor, the author of Real Life. It's his debut novel, and it's fantastic. Brandon is also a senior editor of Electric Literature's Recommended Reading and a staff writer at Literary Hub. Let's do it. All right, everybody. I'm very excited to be sitting here today with Brandon Taylor. Brandon is the senior editor at Electric Literature's Recommended Reading and a staff writer at Literary Hub. He's also a debut novelist whose book is maybe one of the buzziest of the year so far. It's called Real Life. Brandon, welcome to The Stacks.
Thanks for having me.
I'm so excited you're here. Listeners of this podcast will know I'm not a big fiction person. So, everyone, take this and hear what I'm saying. This book is very good. and it's fictiony and it's still very good. And I loved it. And I read it in like 2 days and was just gushing. So you should feel all the things, but congratulations on such an exciting debut.
Thank you so much. That may be the best rec I've ever heard of it.
We'll blurb it for the paperback. Just me gushing.
Let's do it, please. Top of the page.
So before we get to real life, we're going to talk about you for a moment. Just give us kind of like a little rundown where you're from, where you are now. I mean, like just a little, it was a little Brandon preview.
Yeah. So I'm from Alabama. I lived there my entire life until I went to graduate school at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And I was there for about 4 or 5 years. And then I left that to go to graduate school in Iowa City to study creative writing. And I've been there since 2017.
And you're still in Iowa?
Yeah. I graduated in 2019. And right now I'm adjuncting.
Okay.
The writer's dream.
And what are you teaching in your adjunctship?
I'm teaching a class called The Sentence, and they give, you know, they gave me a lot of like free rein of how I would run the class. And so I'm teaching it like a close reading class where I'm trying to give the students tools to, you know, read the text in their lives with more interest and more care and to sort of figure out what interests them as like people and readers.
Huh. That's so cool. And what texts are you using?
I mean, I'm trying to do this thing where I teach mostly people who are alive.
Okay.
Because I think a lot of undergraduates are like, well, I don't really read. And it's because they've been given, you know, like old dead people.
Yeah.
And I love classics a lot. But I think, you know, if you give them people who are publishing today, who are speaking to like their condition in a sort of more contemporary way, they'll really, really love it. And so last week's class, we read Alexander Chi and we read this great essay by C.J. Hauser called The Crane Wife.
Okay.
Because we were talking about fragments and they just loved it. They could not get enough.
That's fun. And I guess if they're alive too and they're publishing in this moment, there's something about like, there's a social media presence maybe. There's like something that makes them feel more human. Because I think sometimes when you're doing like old dead people, it's like, that's not a person.
Yeah, I think it makes the author seem like this distant authority figure in some weird way. And the students, you know, I've had students say like, oh, I'm going to go look this person up and I'm going to go read them. And that's how I found a lot of these writers is I read one little essay in a little magazine and then was like, well, I must know everything about them. and so I'm just like trying to give them a lot of opportunities to like discover new people who they wouldn't have picked for themselves, but like speak to them in interesting ways.
That's very cool. This is your first book.
Yes.
What does that feel like?
It's exciting. I mean, it's strange, but it's very, very exciting. I mean, for a long time, this book lived on my computer.
Right.
And then it was a series of PDFs that I had to check with a red pen with my editors. And then it was, and then it had a cover, and then it was galleys, and then it was, you know, I have all these like physical versions of the book like stacked up, and I sort of look at them sometimes because I really love to see the physical process of it. But now it's in the world, and so it's, you know, it's kind of less physically real to me in some ways, but it's, I don't know, like there's something about people reaching out now and being like, I read your book, I have thoughts and feelings, and that's so exciting, but it's also like, oh no.
Is it scary? Do you care about people's, like, do you care if people have thoughts and feelings about your book that aren't what you think people should think and feel about it?
I mean, the way that I think about it is once I write something, it no longer belongs entirely to me. I have my own version, you know, my own relationship to the text. But once it goes out into the world, it belongs to the people who find it. And my hope is that it finds its readers and that it finds its people. Yes. But any reader who picks up the book, that book now belongs to them. And so it's interesting. I kind of like sort of seeing all the different reads because I think that's how you know a piece of art is alive, is that it can sort of contain all these different meanings from different people.
Yeah.
And I think that if you write something that ultimately has one reading to it, like that's not very interesting.
Mm-mm. Have you had people say things to you where you're like, are you a crazy person? Like, how dare you? Or like any negative things where you've been like, what? Or things have been positive that you've been surprised that that's what people got from your book?
I mean, it's, yeah, I've been mostly surprised in pleasant ways by a lot of the positivity. Though I will say sometimes people write to me and they're just like, actually, science is a very diverse place and your story, you should be more grateful or whatever. And then I'm just like, well, you know, you kind of miss the point of the book,
right,
friend.
Right.
That's okay.
Thanks for coming. Try
totally.
Again.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's been a nice mix of things, but mostly positive and like really interesting reads.
Okay. So we'll talk about actually what's in the book, but we won't spoil anything because all of you need to read it for yourself. The book is about Wallace, who is a grad student in biochemistry at a Midwestern university. He's Black. He's gay. He's from the Southeast. He is kind of an outsider in his group of friends and in his biochemistry. And kind of, it's like one weekend about him. I'm really trying not to say too much about him. His science, it's not experiment, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an experiment.
That sounds like so juvenile, right?
Yeah.
Like science experiment. But his science experiment that he's been working on gets messed up. Basically, that's kind of like the catalyst for this weekend. And he starts reflecting on the whole thing, the whole of his life, really. How did I do?
It's great.
Okay. I didn't spoil anything. But what I found to be so just incredible about this book is how many things you cover, right? So I kind of identified Wallace as Black, gay, science, whatever. But also we talk in this book about microaggressions, about silence, about belonging, about entitlement. When you set out to write this book, were you thinking, I'm going to write a book that encompasses these things? Or did you say, I'm going to write a book about this person who is these things? You know, like, how do you approach your writing as far as what will be covered versus what it's about?
Mm. Yeah, when I set out to write the book, I was mostly thinking, like, I really want to write a campus novel because that's my favorite genre of literature. Except instead of it being like a white straight person, it's going to be like a Black queer person at the center of it. And instead of being in the arts, like usually campus novels are like about literature people or professors. And I was like, no, it's going to be about a grad student because they are overworked and really sad. And it's going to be based in science because like that's what I knew really, really well.
Right.
And I'd never read a book about like the sciences that itself was also just like a sort of traditional campus novel.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was my main starting point. That's the sort of target I painted on the wall for myself. And then when I sort of identified that this character would be like Black and queer, I just, you know, got to work thinking, trying to like deeply imagine like what that experience is like, mm-hmm. which was not that hard because I was like living it as I was writing.
Right.
And I thought about all the things that are, you know, all the things that were like present in my own life that I kind of wished were more reflected in art, you know, like what it really is like to feel seven different kinds of lonely, mm-hmm. like in a space like that.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way that wasn't like simple or pat or easy, but in a way that showed that like everyone can only ever know what they're thinking,
right.
And everyone is capable of doing harm and being harmed in social situations, and it's possible for people to love you and also to hurt you. And so that's really what I was trying to do, is just to sort of get on the page like the full complexity of like that lived experience, so
right.
that it would feel interesting to the reader and not like really boring or simplistic.
Right. I mean, I take notes when I read for the show, and one of the things I wrote down, I can't remember when I wrote it down because I was looking back at my notes, but I wrote down, he doesn't give us the answers. Thank you. And I think that that's something that's really nice about this book, is that it is really complex, and Wallace is navigating a lot of different relationships and situations. And he is, like you said, doing harm and being harmed all in the same moment, in the same scene, in the same sentence. He's, you know, he could be inflicting harm on someone else while also taking it in. And I think that I said this to you before, but this book occupies a space that just feels like it's so specific, and it just feels really full in that hole that it fills. And I think that's really impressive, especially for a debut. Like, that's just so cool. Do you feel like you achieved what you set out to achieve with this book? Do you feel like you hit the target that you painted?
I think, yeah. No, I totally feel that I wrote the book that I wish I'd had. I definitely set out to write this book because it was something that I just really, really wanted to see in the world. And I think the book achieved that. The book to me feels like richly imagined and morally complicated. And it feels, you know, above all else, like it feels true to that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it feels really satisfying, because when I think about this book, I don't think like, oh, I really didn't nail it. I feel like a lot of satisfaction when I think about it.
That's so great. Okay. I know that you probably are going to get this question a million times. This is the beginning of your book tour. And I know that some of Wallace lines up with some of your life. And I'm not going to ask you the question you think I'm going to ask you. What I'm going to say is that you wrote a thing for BuzzFeed News about your life in science. And one of the things you said in that is that you hate being asked about missing science. Why do you hate that question?
I think I hate it because, you know, I hate that question because I can almost always feel the answer they want from me on the other end of it. I can always feel their kind of assumptions about my relationship to science and like what it is I'm going to say, either yes or no. Like, like it's a question that kind of comes packaged with its own answer kind of neatly nestled in the center of it. And it's kind of like when you're standing in line next to someone and you're like, oh, hey, how are you?
Right.
And you don't really expect a nuanced full answer.
Right.
And so when people are asking me that question, often it's sort of in this capacity of just like to pass the time or, you know, or to just get their neat little answers. They can go off and do whatever. And it, you know, and to me, like leaving science was an incredibly like complicated and painful and logistically horrible situation. And so it's like casually asking someone at a funeral if they miss their parent or loved one, you know?
Right.
And so like, that's really why I hate that question. It's not the question itself. It's like the set of like facile assumptions that kind of underpin it, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like asking someone, you know, I sort of liken it in the essay to sort of asking all of these like incredibly rude, invasive questions of people in various states of like exile from various things. And it's not malicious. Like, I don't think the question is malicious. I just think it comes from a place of, you know, the kind of civic inattentiveness that we have when we're in social situations.
Right. Okay. You are a kind of person that I did not know existed because you have a science brain and an arts brain. And part of my whole ability to exist in the world is that I don't have a science and math brain, and that's okay because I have an art brain. But now that I have found you, you've ruined my life.
Oh no.
Like, I basically want you to tell me what it's like to be you, because I don't understand how you can be both things, because in my brain, I never could do the science thing because I could do the artsy thing. Mm. But you do both. Like, what the fuck?
Yeah, I mean, well, I've been thinking a lot about this lately because I've been writing in my new work. I've been writing a lot about like artists and stuff.
Okay.
And I keep being like, why am I so drawn to artists? I know nothing about art. And then I realized like my brother is an art prodigy. Like, he was an arts prodigy, like a full folk painter, sculptor by the time he was like 10 years old.
Okay.
And so it's only now looking back that I'm kind of like, oh, I was always in sort of immersed in the arts. I just didn't think of it in that way.
Right.
But in terms of being like science brained and arts brained, the only thing I can say is like, to me, they're the same thing. Like, they're two kind of modes of seeing the world and observing the world and marking the world and trying to generate meaning. They're both these incredibly regimented processes that don't have any guaranteed conclusions at the end. And, you know, writing a novel that I didn't know I would be able to finish while also doing an intense set of experiments that I didn't know that I would finish is like really crystallized it for me. You know, working in lab in the middle of the night at like pipetting and also thinking about how I needed to write part six of this novel and not knowing if I could like survive any of it. I'm just like, what am I doing? What a series of choices I have made. And so to me, art and science are, you know, they're two forms of the same thing. Like, they've never been separate in terms of like my interest in them or my understanding of them. And I remember, you know, being in various seminars and like watching people talk about, you know, transcriptomics and all this other stuff and just being like, oh, this is like poetry, or like, oh, it's like this obscure sort of Czech novel. And so to me, they've always inhabited more or less the same space in my brain. And I was really bad at math until I got to algebra, which is a sort of more symbolic manipulation kind of mathematics. And that to me made so much sense because I was always thinking in terms of like language and story and stuff. And so once math got to this very abstract place, I suddenly was really, really good at it.
Right.
And once I got to like chemistry and like ways in which I was applying very concrete, like physical laws to the world and breaking it down into expressions and manipulating them, like that to me was the same as writing a story.
Interesting.
And so to me, they're just tapped into the same deep part of the world. Okay. And that's how I operate. But I also one of my best friends from undergrad calls me a freak of nature all of the time because of it. Yeah. So
because it doesn't, like, we're taught that you don't exist, like that someone can't be as special and as talented in both parts of the brains, like, because for us simple people it would be too devastating to know that you existed.
I mean it's kind of sad to me, because if you look at the history of mathematics, like the first mathematicians were philosophers, you know.
Right.
Like all of it flows from the same place.
Right.
And it feels to me that something has been lost, like culturally and societally, by this siloing of like arts and STEM and separate.
Yeah.
Kind of. And I think part of that is just, a lot of it is just the way that math and science in this country are taught.
Yeah.
And a lot of people end up with, you know, overworked teachers who have 30 kids to teach long division.
Right.
And they just don't have the resources, especially in like poorer states and cities.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have the resources they need to give every student the customized attention to sort of teach it to them in a way that makes sense.
Yeah.
But you've got all these standardized tests to do, and so you don't have time to teach in a way that builds genuine understanding or,
right,
like links these different skills up. And I feel really lucky in some ways that I get to live my life in a way that allows this natural flow from like writing literary fiction to,
right,
understanding developmental biology.
Right.
And I get to see how it's all connected. And that's,
right,
something that I wished everyone had, because it's, to me, they're all the same. And it's really, yeah, it makes my life richer in some ways.
Yeah. Did you have a teacher or teachers that fostered that in you? Or you just like, how did you discover that you had both of those in you?
I mean, I just had really great teachers in high school and middle school. I had teachers who taught me to be curious and who taught me to be, you know, just like interested in various things, and that I didn't have to close off parts of myself to be true to other parts of myself. And it also helped that I was just like really, really good at school. Like,
right,
school was the place I felt safe and I felt at home. And,
right,
and I was just, you know, I was really, really good at school.
Right.
And, you know, my brother was not, like, my brother had dyslexia and he had other sort of learning challenges. And so for him, school was this really difficult, brutal, awful place.
Right.
And I think that if you're a person who doesn't have learning challenges, like, it's just much easier for you to be able to tap into these things.
That's
because
true.
Teachers don't have to try as hard to sort of get you to do your,
right,
long division.
Right. And it's not as discouraging. Like,
totally,
you can be trying really hard and still not like getting it.
Absolutely.
Air quote.
Yeah. And so I was really lucky to be able to go to school and it not be a discouraging experience. And I wasn't, you know, sobbing at my desk, and my teacher didn't,
right,
have to exert, you know, all this effort to sort of get me to do my math homework.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's just kind of lucky that I had, one, great teachers, and two, that I just was a really gifted learner from early on.
Yeah. My last little question for you about this book is, it's been pretty buzzy. It's been everywhere. You just posted something about it being in Time Magazine. Is that what it was? What's that like? Like, is it a total trip?
Yeah. My friends keep being like, Brandon, you're so buzzy. And I'm like, is it buzzy? I can't tell. It doesn't seem buzzy from
it
where.
It feels buzzy.
Yeah.
It feels like a bee's hive or something. It's buzzy in a great way.
Oh, well, that makes me feel good. I mean, to me, you know, it's not often that books about queer life and books about like Black people, and certainly books about like Black queer life, don't get the sort of,
right,
all this attention on them. And so when my book was coming out, I just thought like, well, you know, all of these other people will get all the buzz and I'll just be over here with my modest expectations.
Right.
That's okay, as long as this book finds its people. And so like once the anticipated lists start rolling out, I was like, oh, this one. Oh, it's so great. Because I didn't expect it, it just feels like a gift, and
yeah,
it feels really special and it feels good, but I also feel like I can't see it from the outside.
You maybe need some time.
Yeah.
To look back one,
yeah,
day.
I mean, it's very strange because I'm a person, like, publishing is my fantasy football. Like, I love thinking, breaking down the strategy and, like, looking at all the books as they come out and being God. Like, oh, this is their strategy. This is their strategy. Mm. And so it feels really frustrating not to be able to do it for myself. But also maybe that's protective because I feel like I would make myself nuts.
Yeah. You have to just, like, not try to analyze in the moment.
Yeah.
Okay. So before we get to the questions about you, we do a little segment on here called Ask the Stacks where someone has emailed us asking for a book recommendation. So I'm springing this on you, but I think you're going to do great.
Okay.
I didn't even cherry pick this. Okay. This comes from Allison. She says, hello, I am a big nonfiction and memoir reader who has recently read and loved some great character-driven atmospheric novels. I love queer literature, especially by women, but open to all genders. Some recent favorite novels include Brandon Taylor's Real Life and A Little Life. In parentheses, I know. Memoirs I loved include Janine Vanasco's Things We Didn't Talk About When I Was a Girl and Carmen Maria Machado's In the Dream House. I'm hoping for deep backlist books, especially by dead authors and people of color, either nonfiction or novels. So I'll start, give you a little time to think. You only have to come up with like one. You don't have to come up with multiple unless you can. My first one for you, Allison, this is basically nothing that you asked for, but I feel like it's atmospheric and it's a novel and that's all I can do. It's Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel. It's about like a pandemic. It feels very important in this moment of coronavirus. And it's so beautifully written and it takes like a pandemic and what would happen, but it makes it really real. It doesn't feel science fiction-y in a way that we're all like floating in outer space. It feels like if tomorrow this happened, what the fuck would we do? And then the other one I'm going to suggest is The Berlin Stories by Christopher Isherwood. I've actually not read it, but I love Cabaret and I know that it's kind of related to Cabaret the musical. And I have some friends who think it's amazing, but he's old and dead and queer. So check, right?
Yeah, totally.
Okay, your turn.
I'm going to recommend The Price of Salt by Patricia Highsmith,
okay.
who is perhaps most famous for writing The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Ooh.
And also, actually, I'll also recommend The Talented Mr. Ripley. The Price of Salt was made into a movie, the film Carol.
Oh,
which is one of my favorite movies. And it's about this young woman, Therese Bellavette, who's working in a department store, when in walks this, like, tall, beautiful blonde woman.
Is that Kate Blanchett?
Yes. Okay. And she buys a toy for her daughter, but leaves her gloves at the counter, which prompts Therese to get in touch. And then they embark upon this relationship that's like so like interesting and rich and complicated. And Patricia Highsmith's sentences are so beautiful. And the book is so moody. And it's really a fast read. I think it's only like a couple hundred pages. And it's just like so delicious. So good.
Okay, Allison, those are our recs for you. If you read them, you have to let us know. Everybody else, if you want a book recommendation read on the air, email askingthestacks@gmail.com. Okay, we're going to go to our questions. We always start here. Two books you love, one book you hate.
Two books I love. Andre Aciman's Call Me By Your Name.
Okay.
And Garth Greenwell's Cleanness.
That just came out, right?
It did, yeah.
Is it out?
It's out. Okay. I had an early copy. It's so beautiful.
I've heard it's very sexy.
It really is.
I heard it's like all the sexy tingles.
It's so sexy, but more than that, it's like so much about like being a person in the world who's so sensitive to everything.
Okay. And then what about a book you hate?
A book I hate. This is a spicy choice.
Oh, I can't wait.
But I did not like Today Will Be Different by Maria Simple. Like it just...
Oh, I don't know just, that.
Ugh, ugh.
Is she Bernadette?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Which I did love.
Okay.
Enjoy. Love her.
Also Kate
author.
Blanchett.
Also Kate Blanchett. This is the Kate Blanchett hour.
Big Kate Blanchett fans. What didn't you like about it?
I think it just like... I found the characters really simple and there's also some racial language that gets used in it. And I was just like, not into it.
Not here
not
for this.
Not feeling it.
Got it. What about, what's the last really just great book you read?
Oh yeah. How Much of These Hills is Gold by Pam Zhang, which comes out in April. And it's so sweeping, so majestic, moody for days.
Okay.
And it's a Western.
Yeah, it's like about like the gold rush, right?
Yes, it's so good.
I have it here. They sent it to me in a box with all sorts of confetti and stuff, and the pages are gold. It's really sexy.
Yeah, we're best friends. We were at Iowa together.
Oh, you are.
And then we sold our books to Riverhead like 2 months apart.
So you guys are just like embarking on your Riverhead friendship.
Totally.
I mean, is there a sexier place to embark on your book with someone? Like, I feel like Riverhead is just like, they're yeah.
They're my top choice. I love them so much.
And their covers are delicious.
To die.
Your cover. I'm just waiting for Riverhead. We talked about this actually last week on the show because we did another Riverhead book, and their covers are just like,
yes, totally.
So, okay. What are you reading right now?
Right now I am reading, what am I reading? Oh, I'm reading To the Lighthouse.
Okay.
With a Friend by Virginia Woolf.
Okay. Just like as like a two-person book club type situation?
Yeah, I mean, I've read it before. I mean, real life contains all these like homages and allusions to The Lighthouse. And I really, really love it. And he's reading it for the first time. And he kept talking about it. And I was like, I love that part. And I love that part too. You know, like, I'm going to read it.
I'm going to do this. Yeah. I need to get back to this.
Inviting myself into his book club.
Oh my God, that's inviting myself into his personal just reading space and calling it a book club now. It's fine. I had a book club with a friend, just he and I, because we didn't want to take other people's opinions into account when we picked books.
Oh, nice.
We were like, no, we don't want to read what like Karen wants to read. Like we want to read.
Oh, yeah.
How do you pick what you're going to read next?
Often I get sent a lot of books now by publishers, right. And I'll just like look at them when they come in the mail and I'll read the synopsis, and if it's good, I'll sort of dive in. But normally it's, you know, I read the New York Times book review and I read book Instagram,
right.
And whatever pops and looks good, I just, you know, I sort of try to let my natural interest go, because it's really easy to get in a reading slump if you don't.
Yeah. Well, I feel like sometimes with like the Bookstagram community, I end up in a reading slump because I read things that other people gush about, even though I'm like, this isn't really what I would normally pick up. Like sometimes I trust others too much with my reading.
Yeah. So I have to teach myself to learn to read book Instagram, because I'd be like, okay, this is like gushy because the publicist wrote them a nice
right.
note.
Right.
Like, let's read between the lines. Is this something that I would be like interested in, even
right.
tangentially?
Right.
And, yeah. Even if you sort of take other people's recommendations, there's always a part of you that knows.
Right.
If it's going to be a fit.
But sometimes I'm surprised because like, I your book, I was not sure I was going to like, because the people who recommended it like a lot of like novel-y novels. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't know. And then they were right and I was wrong because it's so good. But like sometimes I embark on a book and I'm like, I don't know. We'll see. Like, and then I was wrong.
But see, that is so much fun.
It's the best.
I love it when a book just completely wrongfoots me. And I'm like,
yes.
Did not expect this.
It's the best.
What has happened to me?
Because the opposite is the worst.
Oh,
when
yeah.
you're like, oh my God, I can't wait to read this book. It's going to be so great. I've been saving it for this vacation or something. And then you start reading it and you're like, this is garbage.
Yeah.
I hate that.
Totally. Yeah.
I hate that so much. Okay. What is a book that you like to recommend to people?
Oh, there are so many. I mean, Trust Exercise, okay. for sure. And I have a lot of friends who are into kind of like speculative
okay.
things, and I'm trying to like wean them over to literary.
Okay.
And so I find myself recommending Severance by Ling Ma.
Oh, I have not read that yet.
It's moody and atmospheric, yeah. and it's similar to Station 11. It's
okay.
got some Station 11
oh,
vibes.
Okay.
And I also find myself recommending Andre Aciman's False Papers, like Essays.
Okay.
And also Joan Didion's Blue Nights.
Oh.
Because people who are not, they're like, I'm not into nonfiction. I'm like, you've got to find you.
But not magical thinking.
Right. No, I mean, Blue Nights is, it's not less devastating, but it's, you know, it's more kind of like lyrical and
right.
moody.
Sure.
And it's, I think it's like an easier place to embark rather than like magical thinking, which just like breaks you open.
Yeah.
And has
yeah.
no forgiveness.
Yeah. No. I mean, I love nonfiction. So that's not my problem. Like, oh my God, it happened in real life. I'll read about it. Is there a book that sticks out in your mind that someone's recommended to you that is just like the best recommendation you've ever received?
Yeah, I can't think of one. Oh, you know what? It was this really great like Chopin biography.
Oh.
Pianist Chopin. And yeah, it's really amazing.
That's so specific. Like, that's not something I would think to recommend, but it must be someone you knew well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that sounds
also,
right.
Also, I guess like it's important to note that I read a lot of like dense biographies
okay.
of like historical figures.
That's what other genres? You said that, and then you said something else that was your favorite.
Oh, campus novels.
Campus novels. Yeah. And what else do you like?
I really love like slim memoirs that are okay. very, very particular periods of a life.
Okay.
I love histories, especially like early modern Europe. That's my jam.
Interesting.
I recently read two huge books on the Wars of the Roses.
Okay.
Biographies of artists and pianists I just love so much. I also wrote this really great one of Agnes Martin, who's amazing. And I think those are, and like literary fiction.
Anything you hate? Anything you don't read?
I don't like, my friends make fun of me for this, but I'm just like, I don't like little novellas. Like, I don't like these kind of hyper experimental fiction-y books that are, you know, I'm not into it. I like my realism.
Right.
And I don't like sort of slim novels that feel hyper contrived and drenched in sensibility. Like, that's not my...
Drenched in Sensibility, the sequel to Sense and Sensibility. I love that. Drenched in Sensibility. Do you set any reading goals for yourself?
I used to, but the last couple of years have been impossible. I have this ongoing project to read all of Henry James.
Okay.
And so like that is like the only kind of like ongoing thing I have. But I try to read often. I try to always be reading a book, no matter what's going on. And it's been really frustrating because the last 4 months or so, like, I just have not been able to like lock into a book and finish it.
Right. Do you read multiple things at a time?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I'm one of these bad people I'm always in the middle of like four books.
I feel like that is I am a one book pony, is what I call it. But I think that that's more common what you do. I always thought everybody read like one book at a time. And then I found out that apparently everybody has like six books going.
Yeah. I mean, I always find that really interesting when you find out how someone else reads.
Yes. It's like, that's basically this entire podcast is finding out how other people read.
It's like so alarming sometimes.
Yeah.
Like one of my friends recently said that she skips around in nonfiction books, like dabbling a little here, a little there.
No.
And I was like, I understand that intellectually, but also I would never.
That feels like school when they like photocopy a chapter of a book and you're like, what are we talking about? Like, how did we get here? I need the whole context.
That is like a distinctly strange thing about American education, like getting chapter 15 of like a history book. And it's like, where are the others?
How did we get here? Like, what's happening? Are you a person who like messes up your books? Do you write in your books? Do you fold the pages? Do you use the jacket as a bookmark?
I do use the jacket as a bookmark, but I don't dog ear pages, but I write in books, but only if they're paperback. Like I don't write in hardcover.
Interesting.
But paperback, like I definitely do. And I do it more often in essays, in collections of essays. Like I'm reading I started at the beginning of the year, The White Album by Joan Didion. Mm. And Joan Didion and I have a high write-in rate with Joan Didion. I'm always like underlining and writing down things that she says. So in kind of like critical texts and in collections of essays, I definitely write in my books.
And why not in hardcover?
I don't know. That feels like a real trespass.
Okay.
There's something that feels kind of like, oh, I bought this little paperback from the store. It doesn't cost that much.
You're the second person to say this, which is, I'm just fascinated. Mm-hmm. I've never heard this before.
Yeah. Writing in a hardcover book maybe it's like a sort of ancestral memory of like education when you're not supposed to write in the textbook.
Right. You have to turn it back in.
Yeah. And I think also it's just like harder to write in a hardcover. Like, it's just physically harder.
Right, because you can't like bend it in half kind of thing. That's so interesting. If you're in your ideal reading setup, where are you? What does it look like? What does it feel like?
Oh, yeah. I'm like at home under my slightly heavy gray duvet.
Okay. You have a weighted blanket?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not weighted, but it might as well be. Like I bought this very thick duvet because it's Iowa.
Right.
And so you meet all the time. And so it's like... it feels weighted and it's so comfy and it's so cozy. And it's like me under the duvet, with like the book like propped above my head, like reading it.
Like peeking out.
Yeah, totally.
So it's winter time.
Usually, yeah. Okay. Or summer. I mean, I have a fan. My apartment doesn't get very warm. Thank goodness. Yeah.
Does it get warm in Iowa?
Yes.
It does.
It gets hotter than the South, which I hate.
Oh,
so
no. Because the South, but is it humid up there too?
Yes, that's why it's.
Oh, no.
It's all the corn. Like it didn't used to be, but because of all the agriculture, like it's changed the climate of Iowa.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
It's horrible.
Do you think you'll stay there for a while? Do you like it there?
I do like it. I mean, Iowa City is a great city to be a writer because it's everyone is a writer in Iowa City. And it's cheap. And so I'm figuring out my life right
now. Sorry, that's like really personal. You're like, leave me alone.
No, I mean, I'm figuring out my life right now. But it's a great place to kind of sort that stuff out.
Yeah, that's so cool. Okay, back to books. What's the last book that made you laugh?
Oh, To the Lighthouse. There's this really hilarious moment where she calls one of the male characters a miserable specimen. She's so mean.
I love mean. What about the last book to make you cry?
I think it was Pam's How Much of These Hills is Gold. Like, it's just, yeah.
What about the last book where you felt like you learned a lot?
Yeah, Alison Weir's Lancaster in New York. Mm. Yeah, I'm learning so much, even though I literally right before it read another book about the same period of history. I'm just learning so much about, it's like getting the other side of the story.
Right.
It's so juicy.
And you just, what about the War of the Roses?
Well, I mean, it was a period of history that I didn't know much about. And I always found it like kind of tedious. I was like, all the Henrys and Edwards and I don't care. And the Richards, like, who cares? Just skip right on over it. And so it was just like a period of like English history, especially that I kind of knew, but I didn't know a lot about. And so I was like, well, I'm on semester break. I might as well just like
go nuts,
dig in. And it was a really rewarding experience.
Are you familiar with those stories through Shakespeare at all?
No, I mean, I do know the Shakespearean plays, but most of that knowledge just comes from reading a bunch of other books about.
Because I only know it through Shakespeare. Mm. I only know it through like the Henry plays and the Richards and whatever. So it's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's not accurate. I mean, it's not accurate, but it is accurate about the mood. Like,
well, I'm sure Shakespeare's plays are not accurate about the history for sure, but I just was curious if that was something that you had experienced it through that way too. But if it's good, maybe I'll check it out. I love a history.
It's so juicy.
Yeah.
It's so good.
It's so dramatic.
Yeah.
Would make a great Shakespearean drama. I don't know.
Truly.
Okay. What about a book that brings you joy?
What is that?
I don't know. It's up for you to answer.
My reading life. A book that brings me joy. Oh, the book Little by Edward Carey. It's this fictional history of Madame Tussaud, the woman who did all the waxworks.
Yeah. Was she a little person?
She was very, very short.
Sorry, I didn't mean like a little person. I meant like, was she a little smaller person?
Yeah, she was really, really short. Huh. And it's got all these really great illustrations. And it feels kind of like a Grimm's fairy tale in some ways. And it's just one of those books that you just crawl right inside of, and you get to just, for a period of, you know, 4 or 5 hours, get to just like hang out inside of this really imaginative, kind of quirky work. And it was moving, and it just brought me a lot of joy as like a reader. It was just a lot of fun.
I love that. I love when books are just like a good time, like a good hang.
Yeah.
What's a book that you're proud to have read?
Oh, Another Country by James Baldwin. Mm. That was the first time I saw queer black characters in fiction, and it just like remapped my brain in some really important way. And I think it's one of the most important books in this nation's history. It's so incredible.
That's good. What about a book that you're embarrassed that you've not read yet?
Oh, this list is so long. I mean, it's sort of a cliche, but like Moby Dick, like I keep starting it and then not following through.
Someone just said this the other day. That episode hasn't come out yet, but someone just said that.
Yeah. And as of like a couple of years ago, it was Portrait of a Lady. Like I'd never read that, but then I read it and I was like, oh my God, everyone should read this. This is amazing.
Why hasn't anybody read this book? I've never read any of the books that people say that they're embarrassed about not having read. And so then I'm like, oh my God, should I be embarrassed? I've never read that book. I've never even heard of it.
No, your value system is your own.
Yeah. And I've never read it like a million things. There's just so many things.
Yes.
But it's such a fun one to hear what people come up with. What book is your problematic fave?
Oh, there are so many. I mean, I know the answer to this question, and it's absolutely My Struggle by Karl Ove Knausgård.
Okay. You said his name. I could never do it.
Love his writing so much. I love all of those books. he is such a problematic fave. I mean, he called his book My Struggle.
Right.
I mean, like, yikes. And, but I just, they're so important to me, like, as a writer. They just completely, but I acknowledge the deeply problematic things that he says and does in this book.
Right. Oh my God. I love a problematic fave. What about a book that you love that captures where you're from? Are there any?
That I love?
Sure.
I don't know.
Okay.
Well, that's not true. There's this book called In West Mills by Deshaun Charles Winslow. Mm-hmm. And it's not about Alabama, and it's, you know, and it's not contemporary, but it, when reading that book, it made me so homesick because he so captures the people that I know from home, and he captures everything that is like great and beautiful about growing up in a small Southern Black community. And it just gets everything right about what is so good and also so complicated about that. And I think it's just, In West Mills.
Okay.
Certainly the book that, to me, maybe the only book that's ever made me homesick.
Wow. I love that. What's a book that you would assign in school to high school kids? Since you assign things to college kids.
I give them all the things. I think How to Write an Autobiographical Novel by Alexander Chi. I think as a book, it contains all these different styles and modes. And it talks so much about being a writer, but it also contains all of these passages about just like growing up. And there are all these essays about him as like a younger person dealing with like trauma and dealing with feeling out of place and what it's like to be a young, intelligent person in the world.
Right.
And it's just like one of those books that you can read at any age and learn a lot. But I think young people especially, I think it's a great book because I think young people today are so creative and they're so interested in all these different ways of how to be in the world. And they're so smart and sensitive. And I think that's just like a perfect book for a young, creative, sensitive person.
Yeah. You're right. Young people are super creative and sensitive right now in a way that's sort of fantastic.
Yeah.
Like TikTok.
I know.
Like I could never.
And Vine before it.
Vine.
Know? I mean, it just to me, I teach, you know, teach undergraduates now. And before I taught undergraduates, I thought, oh, like as a generation, they're just like lazy and they don't even know words and they text in emoji and whatever. But, you know, I have found my students to be so attentive. They're such engaging readers. They work so hard and they care so much about their families, about their friends, about the country, about the world, about the planet. They're so selfless and they're so like interesting on the page. They're such interesting thinkers. And so I think that, you know, there's a tendency, I think, among millennials to kind of like scoff at younger people, at the Zoomers. But I think they're so, I just find I find them so inspiring and interesting.
There's hope for the future.
Yeah.
Well, everyone likes to shit on the generation behind them.
Yeah.
Like we're millennials and they just like were so horrible to us. I'm like, leave me alone.
Yeah.
I'm lovely. Get to know me, please. Okay, boomer. Who, you can't say yourself, who would you want to write the book of your life?
Because they know me well or because I love their writing?
That is up to you.
I think I would want one of my dear friends, Huxley, to write the book of my life. He's, you know, he doesn't have a book out or anything, but he's just like one of the most beautiful writers ever. And we've been friends since we were like 19, 20.
Oh, wow.
And plus he knows so much about my life.
Right.
He was there.
So he's both things.
Yeah.
Knows you well and is a beautiful writer. Mm. And is he like wanting to write a book? Is he a writer by trade or is he just someone that you happen to know writes beautifully?
We used to write collaboratively a lot when we were younger.
Cool.
And so he's like trying to figure out his life.
Well, come on, Huxley. We want to read your words. Boom. Yeah, let's do it.
I'm working on it.
Okay. Yeah. We'll just add a little pressure. Last one. I stole this from the New York Times. So you said you read the New York Times, so you'll recognize this one. If you could require the current president of the United States to read one book, what would it be?
I mean, there are so many. Maybe we get him an Audible subscription. I think I would want him to read The Constitution.
Yes.
be a good place to have started before he took the job.
I mean, perhaps.
Yeah.
Like the Constitution, one. And I think, like, get him all of Hannah Arendt, just all of it.
I don't even know what that is.
She's this, I think she's German, writer, scholar, thinker, and she writes a lot about totalitarianism and fascism and the world in which we live today. Yeah. Hannah Arendt. He just needs. And in lieu of that, Rebecca Solnit.
Sure. Mm-hmm. I know who that is. Those all sound like great suggestions, Mr. President. Okay. So we're done here for now. At the end of the month, Brandon is back. We're talking about Trust Exercise by Susan Choi. It's a novel with lots of twists, and we will be spoiling it. We'll be talking about everything. So I'm telling you this now, this very first week of April, so that the very last week of April, you're not mad at me when we spoil the book. You have five Wednesdays. There's five Wednesdays this month. Go read Trust Exercise. And then when you finish that, or maybe before, make sure you pick up your copy of Real Life by Brandon Taylor. Brandon, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's been a blast.
This is such a treat. We'll be back soon with Trust Exercise. And we'll see you guys in the stacks. That's it for us today. Thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you to Brandon for being my guest. And a huge thank you to the folks over at Riverhead for making this interview possible. We will be back with Brandon on April 29th to discuss the Stacks Book Club pick for April, Trust Exercise by Susan Choi. Find everything we discussed in today's episode in the link in the show notes. You can get book recommendations read on air just for you by sending an email to askingthestacks@gmail.com. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and at @TheStacksPod_ on Twitter, and check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. Remember to check out our newest partner, Libro.fm, and use the code THESTACKS at checkout to get 3 audiobooks for the price of 1, and support your local bookstore while you do it. Make sure you're subscribed to this show wherever you get this podcast. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, please take a moment to rate and review the show. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tegirigis. This show was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas. I will see you in the stacks.